Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Chris Gambino, your channel host. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Nicoletta Battini about the new book, The Economics of Sustainable Food, Smart Policies for Health and the Planet. Dr. Battini, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Chris. Thank you.
So Nicoletta, if you will, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So I'm originally from Italy, and I am currently the lead evaluator of the International Monetary Fund, working in the Independent Evaluation Office of the IMF. I came to the U.S. about a good 17 years ago, and this was not my first job. So my very first job was at the Bank of England. I was advisor to the Monetary Policy Committee. I was basically, my background is monetary economics, a lot of inflation, a lot of interest rates. After a few years there, which was fantastic, I decided to look out, and the career brought me to the research department of the IMF, where I covered a number of areas, and including deficits and demographic change, globalization. As part of that, I started looking more into issues, of course, related to fiscal policy. And the IMF is very, very focused on fiscal policy. So, I kind of rounded myself up from monetary into fiscal. And I started working on countries. I even moved to Peru for the IMF, where I was resident representative for 2 years in Lima. It was a wonderful opportunity to know that region and, firsthand to actually see a lot of the commodity production that happens in the world, from gold mining to gas production to extraction to things like, of course, agriculture and, dairy production and so forth. Fisheries. Peru is, in the 70s was the largest exporter of fish to the world. And after that, I came back to the United States, to our headquarters in 2008, when, the global financial crisis was now brooming, there were visible signs of that already. And I worked on Chile. And then I actually worked on the United States and Canada during the crisis, and then moved to European countries, the Nordics, Israel. And so I did a lot of going around the IMF, which is a big institution. And then I went to Rome. I worked for a couple of years. I took some leave, and I was director of the Office of International Economics and Policy of the Treasury. And then I returned back and had other countries, including France. And at that point, I started really, I was looking already for the U.S. I wrote a paper back in the 2011, 2010 on the fiscal aspects of the U.S., particularly the fiscal gap, which is, you know, how much IOU the U.S. has risen to because of it, the fact that expenditure exceeds revenues, including from, you know, the future commitments. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, medical care, medical mandatory spending. And as the more I looked at the issue of fiscal spending and where a lot of that originates, the more I got closer to the fact that a lot of that originates, of course, in health issues and healthcare spending. And then over the years, I figured out that a lot of that, reading, you know, reports by the World Health Organization and many other studies, that basically relates to diets. And then when all this, you know, the noise and the concerns about climate change came about, I just started, you know, connecting dots with the dietary situation and the impact on fiscal accounts of so many countries, and the fact that maybe it was also the fact that agriculture itself was being crafted by policy in a way that was disconnected from food policy. And that led to, you know, distortions in prices that actually nudged consumers to consume possibly more of the stuff that they shouldn't consume and in greater quantities in some countries, or, you know, vice versa in other countries, to consume too little of the good things because you know, marketing and the industry convinced them, even in those lower income countries, even those emerging market countries, that it's good to eat stuff that is actually not healthy. And so I started digging. And I went down the rabbit hole. And I thought, this is a really sexy topic for an economist, because people haven't thought about this before. It has a really huge macroeconomic impact in a variety of areas of the macroeconomy, you know, from production to productivity, to jobs, to fiscal accounts. And I decided to embark into, a publication that could cover all these aspects. Of course, I couldn't possibly conceive doing it alone, so I decided to do an edited contribution. And I went out and recruiting, you know, what I think are the best experts, the best practitioners out there. And that's how the idea of this book, Chris, came about, the Economics of Sustainable Food, which just came out in June 8, published by Island Press and the International Monetary Fund. And I'd like to run you through some of the sections, because I think it really fills a gap in the literature, and I see it very much as a manual, like a handbook that takes people of all, you know, from all areas of policy, but also, you know, academia, through what are the both environmental but economic challenges posed by current food systems, and especially focus then on how to fix those through public policy, which is an under discussed topic today. We talk a lot about the dangers of food systems, you know, the damages they do, but there's little about, okay, so what policies do we need and how do we decline them at the country level to make sure that they're effective in different countries in different ways to achieve the same sustainability and health objectives.
I agree completely. And you do, it is an edited volume. So that's one thing that we should definitely note. You bring a lot of expertise yourself, expert knowledge to the table. But as you just described, you have a vast and deep experiential as on the ground and in the field knowledge that shows up. As well as your counterparts in this edited volume. And you mentioned kind of the connections that you started to see bubble up throughout your career. And the book does just dive into how everything is interconnected. And so it is this very complex, but and in the front end, it is a manual, and you talk about who should read this, who is this for, who can kind of start engaging this content. And I think that y'all lay that out really well. And you put the book section. So let me talk about the book sections for a moment. You've got kind of four sections you lay out: the production side of things, the consumption side of the system, food waste, which is continually a big topic, and sustainable land use. So those are the four major sections. But when we start the book, you kind of identify right off the bat that this conversation is stemming from the industrialized agriculture and fishing, and how that has distorted food system over time, both for people and economies. And you recognize essentially five negative externalities. Could you talk a little bit about the negative externalities in a little bit more detail?
Yeah, so the food system is, of course, one of the two, you know, big contributors to climate change. And this is often, you know, not well understood or not by the general public. You know, people think that climate change is basically a consequence of us burning fossil fuels. And that's, you know, very true that burning fossil fuels contributed tremendously to climate change. But food systems also contribute to climate change in many different ways, also because they are fossil fuel based these days, but mostly for reasons which are unrelated to fossil fuels. And so when I looked at this issue, you know, I immediately recognized that the problem is a bit more complex than organizing or thinking, studying a transition in the energy sector, because in the energy sector, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, calls energy a sector, but in economic terms, you know, energy is not a sector. What's a sector? Or that's electricity or power sector. Then you have transportation. Then you have industry. Then you have agriculture, fisheries, and land use, and so forth. But for the purpose of aggregating greenhouse gas emissions, they call, you know, all the sectors that use electricity energy sector, and the energy sector transition requires basically to make power generation sustainable. Right. So then you can basically go at a lot of the sources and just make sure that when you produce that power, you make it in a sustainable way. So, and we do have solutions for that. We have renewables, and of course we have nuclear. Large hydro is, you know, was an option. Now it's mostly exploited. So we have, you know, these two big sources. People are thinking about hydrogen, but hydrogen itself has to be crafted through energy use, and therefore people are talking about nuclear, hydrogen, and so forth. For food systems is more complex, and you have a number of endpoints that you need to work at once. And so one is supply and the other is demand. But there's a third area, which is food waste, because what we don't eat is as important as what we eat, because we throw away a lot of it. So they say that, according to some estimate, that if food system was a country, it'd be the third largest emitting country in the world. And food waste happens for different reasons in different countries, you know, and we can go a little bit more in detail into that. So solutions different depending on the income tier of a country and, you know, how production and consumption are structured. But the fourth area, which is really important in a redressing food system, is a conservation, because nature and the natural ecosystems are not just a kind of quintessential input in our food production, but they are also, key for carbon sequestration. And why is that related to food system? Well, because basically half of the existing land on Earth is used by agriculture, and there is a trade-off between using land for agriculture and using it for conservation. And since we know that part of the climate agreements that we have pledged to and the path that we need to embark on to save the planet and ourselves is that we need to mark off a third of the planet for conservation, if we are not doing agriculture well and, you know, effectively using the land in a smart way, we're basically eating into that 30%, and we are compromising our ability to you know, protect these ecosystems, which have a climate role because they are carbon sinks. So, you know, the way we use land and seas is very important for climate or earth system stability, and that goes through ag and fisheries. Because these are the culprit, the number one cause of the degradation of natural ecosystems, the number one cause of biodiversity loss.
And so you've laid out kind of the big points of the book, and you lay out these externalities to kind of really talk about these are all the ways that the current system, which you recognize and your counterparts recognize in latter chapters, that, I mean, there's reason for the industrialization. There was reason for the quote unquote green revolution. And now we have to think about, okay, it did its job. And now we have to think about all the things that came with that, all the consequences that resulted from that we're dealing with. And that you've been still dealing with in one point of the book. And so the fix is, right, the thesis of this is the great food transformation. And you say there's three steps toward that. One, for policymakers to understand public health, economic, and environmental trade-offs between the food system and other uses for land. Two, society needs very clear frameworks to guide the shifts at both country and regional levels. And then third is the economic policies and kind of structural reforms to make the transformation happen. And you wrote, in quote, the design of economic policies to make a food transformation happen is much sketchier. And so that's what I want to focus on for a little bit is these policies. Like, you note that steps one and two, we have a pretty good grasp of, and then we're moving into the policies. And that's where it gets a little trickier because there's not a whole lot of evidence. There hasn't been a whole lot of, there are some cases that you point to in the book that are successes or even moving towards successes, but let's talk a little about the design of these economic policies. What's available?
So as I said at the beginning, there's a disconnect between food policy and agricultural policy. Agricultural policy, as you pointed out, we're born really in some countries, in most countries after the Second World War, in some countries like the U.S., maybe in the 30s and 40s. When, you know, countries really suffered to a great extent production problems and even hunger, you know, in large swaths of the population because of either, you know, financial crises or the way the land had been treated and the way it became very quickly unproductive. Those policies have been basically devised to only maximize yields. Maximizing yields led to a series of policy actions that, you know, were for mechanization, for industrialization, and for a greater and greater use of force in the against nature, we could say, you know, in fostering almost artificially abnormally amounts of output, with little regard for the quality of the output, and with little regard for the people that were working in those sectors. People were just kicked out because a machine would replace them. It was fine, you know, that was part of the progress that we had to go through. And if nature had to be, for lack of better words, raped through the use of, you know, chemicals all sorts of heavy machinery. That was fine because, you know, these policies now were serving a higher purpose, the purpose of feeding, you know, those that didn't have food on the table. While this statement maybe was true at the beginning, you know, at the beginning of what they call the Green Revolution, which was this transformation towards, heavy industrialization of the sector, clearly it isn't correct now, because if you look at, where we stand on nutrition, we have a situation where we overproduce in some countries and underproduce in other countries, with all through same methods, because of those farming practices and those fishing activities. And billions of people in the world, are malnourished. They're either overnourished or undernourished. And so the system, the highly high-tech, industrialized and innovative configuration that we worked out the way to farm in modern times, it is actually completely inept to feed us. You know, it leaves a lot of us out. And even those that have access to food and can kind of regulate themselves in eating the right quantity, it's very hard to find the right quality. And that usually comes at a very high price, at a premium to what one should pay for healthy food. And so it's inaccessible for large chunks of the population, creating what I call, health inequalities and food inequalities of immense, immense proportions. So, the policy is a culprit here that really caused the system. And so the solutions lie in changes to the economic policies and structural reforms. And there is very little about it because, first of all, as I say in the book, and in the first chapter, macroeconomists have washed their hands of this problem. Macroeconomists think that agriculture and fisheries are almost not worth looking at because the value added of these sectors is very small. Value added being, what is produced minus what are inputs that go into it. So it's like the additional value that the sector produces. And that's, that's a consequence of the way the system is structured, because the inputs are expensive and a lot of inputs, chemical inputs, fossil fuel inputs, land has become extremely expensive. And therefore, when you subtract all that, the value added looks small. But that shouldn't detract us from knowing and acknowledging that, food is what keeps us alive. I mean, we all eat three times a day. Food is our energy. More importantly, food is production, is the largest employer in the world, because while it employs only 5% of the labor force in advanced economies, it still employs an enormous amount of people in non-advanced economies. And so if we were to move to those economies towards the advanced economies way of farming, those billion jobs would be lost, and we would have a massive unemployment situation and great uncertainty and so forth. So the policies are, essential. They do vary depending on countries, but there hasn't been enough, I think, thinking of how to shape them organically across these four areas that we talked about, which is, working simultaneously on supply, on demand, on food waste and conservation. And what we do here in the book with the co-authors and authors is to really, taxonomize and identify a number of policies that are going to work well in a lot of countries. And then we also give country case examples of successful policies in some of these areas, so people can get a sense what the benefits, the economic benefits, and of course health and environmental benefits of doing things right. If I were to explore the policy angle a little bit more, I mean, a lot of these policies are fiscal policies, so they have to do with the usual taxes and subsidies, tax exemptions. But a lot of policies have to do with regulation, which is also in the economic policy domain. And some policies have to do with structural reforms. So changing the way, you know, markets work, which is, of course, a domain of public policy. And then there are, you know, some ancillary policies that can be used to guide the transformation, which, you know, relate to investment. So governments have to make the great transformation in food systems happen, they have to invest in research and development, for example, in nutrition, because, you know, it's one of the most important areas that we still need to and disentangle to be effective at changing nutrition policies. They have to invest in, for example, just to throw some examples, you know, in weather systems, in, you know, big data to lower insurance costs for farmers. And there's a huge role for public investment. These are actually small investment in magnitude, but they can make a tremendous difference, and they can provide tremendously valuable public goods for the transition in food systems.
Yeah, I agree to a lot of your points, and you've noted, and you make a very clear distinction that between kind of current state of things and as well as kind of these policy mechanisms needed to drive this great food transformation between advanced economies and what y'all call less advanced economies. And even with that distinction and knowing there's things that can happen in one type of economy versus another, you also note, and hopefully our listeners are well aware, that's a little bit more complex. Even you mentioned subsidies as one mechanism. Even subsidizing kind of industrial practices in advanced economies and that commodity pricing program impacts the less advanced economies. Even if the less advanced economies don't want it to, it's more complicated than just there's mechanisms in each of these types of scenarios, but they cross over. So subsidies in one place can make food prices cheaper in another place that changes what would happen in country. Can you talk a little bit more about that complexity?
Yes, absolutely. So this is, I mean, a well-known fact that, you know, if an advanced economy subsidizes its industrial agriculture, that usually, as it's been happening in the past since, you know, the 50s and 60s, it can lead, and it does lead, to overproduction. And the overproduction is basically reversed or poured onto global markets, which means that smaller producers or medium producers in unsubsidized countries that are, you know, less prosperous are competed out. They're competed out of their own production. So say, you know, cheap rice arrives from a country that subsidizes heavily its rice production. And, you know, the farmer producing rice in that country still faces higher cost of production because first it's not subsidized and second it's not as industrialized. And therefore, you know, loses his job or her job. And there is an influx, you know, of this oversupply that comes from a large subsidized advanced economy production system. And that, since in a lot of countries, agriculture is, as we discussed, it's a huge employer, that basically creates, you know, a lot of discomfort, economic discomfort and stress in a lot of countries. It also makes so that food prices become basically a vagary of, you know, commodity markets more generally, because, for example, food prices depend heavily on the price of fertilizers, which in turn, under industrial agriculture, of course, which uses fertilizers, chemical fertilizers, and those fertilizers, you know, are heavily linked to the price of oil because, you know, they are synthetic and fossil fuels enter the equation. And therefore, food prices get linked to oil prices. So now these countries that got, you know, the bad end of the stick and they lost their ability to produce in a competitive fashion food and now import it because of the laws of the market are at the, you know, at the mercy of international food prices and commodities markets oscillations. We saw that very clearly in 2007 and 2008 when, you know, oil prices skyrocketed and they brought with them food prices. And that pushed, just by that happening of the few quarters, you know, something in the order of 40 to 50 million people into straight poverty and hunger. So, you know, there are immense and immediate spillovers of policies, agricultural policies in, you know, richer countries onto lower income countries. They really prejudicate the abilities of these countries to develop. And this is not just subsidies, it's also regulation. For example, you cannot import in the European Union, according to a regulation called the Novel Food Regulation, you cannot import any food that hadn't entered or been marketed in the European Union before a certain year, which is quite far back, like I think it's, you know, the 90s or the 80s. But don't quote me on that, but it's, you know, it goes far back. So imagine you're a, you know, a farmer in the Amazon and you discover a berry that, you know, is then proven to be a perfect fighter for obesity or influenza or what have you. Well, you just cannot commercialize it in the EU because there's a regulation that says, was it being traded before in the EU, before this year? No, we just found it. Well, you can't sell it here. And, you know, there are a bunch of other things which I won't go into, like the size of food, you know, the color of food, which regulate which foods can enter countries. And that's another way in which, you know, agriculture in these other countries is impeded, is impaired. And so, yes, the public policy has a big role to play. And the market is very global. So it's very concentrated vertically and horizontally. And that means that, of course, you know, a lot of these big companies which now hold there's one company that holds, you know, two thirds of the seed market, two thirds of the patented, herbicide, two thirds of the numbers are just stunning because in market concentration terms, when a market, a dominant player holds more than 20%, is considered, a trust, is considered, you know, a high concentration. And here we're talking about concentration levels of, you know, 70-80% of the market in the hands of, you know, one, two large global producers. So a lot of these producers, of course, are very influential. You know, people talk about lobbies, food lobbies or agricultural lobbies all over the world. And they do influence policy. So, you know, some people say they write their own policies at this point. They just are very closely connected with, you know, legislators, and that's how the system keeps floating in the way it's configured. So to change it, you know, there needs to be consciousness about, you know, the larger implications of what's going on here. And there needs to be a connection made between agriculture policy and food policy. Now, the good news here is that agriculture, you know, even the big players are now aware that, A, consumers have become more conscious about the food choices, and that comes out very, very vividly in consumer service, retail consumer service, where, you know, there's been a very detectable shift in the way people seem to decide about the dietary choices. this is in part generational because, you know, millennials and Gen Z have a complete different mindset about what they eat and what they should eat. But it's also, you know, related to the fact that there have been a bunch of reports, for example, about meat consumption and the impact on health and other aspects of, you know, food safety that have created public scares globally. And people have become much more attentive to what they eat. And where it comes from and how it's produced. And that's, you know, producers have become aware of that because people are moving, you know, with their shopping carts, and that feels, it hurts. It hurts profits. And so they're now willing to move, and they've themselves invested in more sustainable ways of production, you know, put a foot in there. They just, you know, put a chip on the roulette table, just one, just to see what happens. But the other big reasons why, you know, this big oligopolies are moving is climate change. Climate change is actually impairing or jeopardizing the ability of, you know, big industrial farms that monocrop, that use a lot of fertilizers, and use a lot of water where water shouldn't be used or should be used much more parsimoniously for more indigenous types of, you know, crops and animals. They become aware that this is, you know, this game is going to end pretty soon because soil is globally degraded or very degraded. Water is, you know, now being pumped out at rhythms that are completely incompatible with water sustainability concepts. I mean, I can go into the details of what's going on, you know, from China to Saudi Arabia to the United States to parts of Africa. But I think it's, you know, it's very well known that a lot of these countries have now pumped out water from fossil aquifers. These are unreplaceable aquifers. And, you know, the number of wells and pumps that are being installed daily is just mind-boggling. And water's just, you know, you have to go deeper and deeper and deeper to bring it out. And some areas of India, you know, some states, half of all electricity is used to pump water out because there just isn't water at shorter or closer locations, you know, under the crust. So you have to go 1,000 feet down. So climate change is a big game changer for this, the food system and those who are involved into production. And so they have become a little bit more responsive. I mean, of course, they're playing end game, like, you know, the oil industry saying, let's see how much more we can profit of this before we jump into a new way of producing. But they're scared. And so I think it's a good moment to start thinking and writing down this these new policies and see how they play out in the, you know, in the public domain. There's definitely support from public opinion globally.
Yes, you make a great case for all of those in the book. And so we've talked now about some of the supply side issues and policy mechanisms. You just started talking about some of the demand side, also talking about kind of the private companies and how they're starting to see the wind shift and becoming big players in transitioning for this kind of great food transformation. Can we dive into, with the time we have left, can you talk a little about like one or two of the policy mechanisms, levers that y'all discuss with regard to the food waste section and then also with regard to the conserving or sustainable land use section?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, people listening in understand that, you know, if we don't change, a lot of people talk about, and we discussed at the beginning, that there's almost a dichotomy. We need to work on the energy transition first because it's important. But, you know, research and science has just shown that if we left food systems as they were, just, and we stop fossil fuel tomorrow, which of course is impossible. Tomorrow, all fossil fuel is just waved out. Well, the food system as it is now, given agriculture trends, population trends, and dietary shifts, would bring us three times over our 1.5 Celsius permitted increase in global warming that would lead to a complete imbalancing of the air system. So food systems are very important. A low hanging fruit that you mentioned is food waste. So food waste is kind of a quite easy area for policy to make a tremendous difference. But the way one goes about that, it varies depending on, you know, where the food waste or food loss occurs. So in lower income countries, food waste or food loss mainly happens in the supply chain, so at the production level. And that means that, you know, either food rots on the fields or when food is produced, it's stored, but it's not stored well, and being perishable, it just goes bad. There are enough, you know, cooling storage facilities because that's expensive, or transportation is not good enough because the very infrastructure is not good enough. And so the time it takes, you know, to bring some fruit from, you know, for example, the Amazons in Peru to the coast where it gets shipped, for example, to, you know, the North America, is quite long. It takes about a couple of days drive. I don't know if you've ever traveled those regions there, you know, the infrastructure is still very primordial. And if you make it to the coast, then with your cargo on a truck, then, you know, some of those will probably have not, you know, made it, some of those products. And so, you know, there really the intervention of public policy is to, first of all, invest in weather and satellite imagery to facilitate the, you know, the more nimbleness of farming practices that allows, for example, crops to be harvested, you know, before a storm or before, you know, a weather event that might destroy part of that crop and make it to be lost. Also invest in cooling systems and cooling storage facilities so that people can, you know, cooperatively or as a community store, you know, in common storage systems. And also, of course, transportation investments, which, you know, are good for many other reasons, not just commerce, but of course, they're very important to kind of vitalize areas of land that are, you know, rural, but that are, you know, can be the engine of production of some particular food. So that's for those, you know, for those regions and those types of countries. For advanced economies, there's much more efficiency in production. So there isn't much loss in production, but there's most of the loss occurs at the consumer level, and some of it occurs at the retail level in supermarkets and grocery stores. And so, you know, for consumers, there's a lot of ways that one can go about. And some of this is, you know, it could be education campaigns, but a lot of it, and, you know, really instilling a no waste culture in from kids, you know, to people at different ages, but also has to do with the way, you know, the restaurant and catering is regulated. So, you know, you can prohibit, for example, the good food that is not gone bad to go to waste. You have to, you can compel, you know, restaurants and bars to donate that food, you know, create special food banks, organize or have them get organized into transportation to food banks and so forth. Loosen regulation that impede, you know, the donation of food to some of these food banks. And then there's a lot of work that is happening now, which is in part, you know, innovative, which is that of doing this so-called dynamic pricing in supermarkets. And that, again, you know, there's a role for policy in making it legit and also supporting it through, you know, research and investment and innovation, which is basically linking, setting different prices for products that have different expiration dates. So if you go buy a sandwich and you got two sandwiches in front of you, one expiring, you know, on June 26 and one expiring on June 28, I think both of you and I would probably go for the June 28, like, you know, it looks fresher because it has a later expiration date. if it's priced the same, you know, the consumer will go for the one with the later expiration date. But if it's priced more than the one that has a, you know, a closer expiration date, we probably make a, you know, wise decision. This is still perfectly edible food. I mean, it hasn't expired. It's 2 days from expiration. I'll buy the cheaper one. And you know, these are ideas that can, you know, that can really help, you know, change the system and save enormous amount of food. Which, you know, basically, we're trashing the planet for food that we don't eat. If we go into conservation and managing, you know, sustainably lands and seas, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of public policy responsibility in the way land and seas are used. And it's kind of not evident. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, national parks, although a lot of land is saved, for example, in the U.S. through, you know, the national park system. But this has to do really with the way, you know, land is you know, regulated and administered in countries. And the same relates to seas. So there, one can impose a number of, you know, either, you know, incentives through tax incentives or subsidies, cross compliance to conservation that fosters a conservation mentality. When, for example, the Farm Bill, you know, some of the iterations of the Farm Bill, you know, for example, you know, in the 60s and 70s became, you know, the yield became the most important thing quickly. And so the mantra was, you know, get big or get out. And it was really a mentality of farming every single inch of the land. So you wouldn't leave anything to, you know, a flower or to a cover crop or to anything like, you know, hedges. And we know that those areas are also part of conservation. They're essential for pollinators and other, you know, ecosystems that are important for food. But we also need policies to, you know, for big protection of contiguous areas, both at land and at sea. And that has to go through a number of initiatives that basically give a price for farmers to convert their lands into rewilded areas. So the idea that we have in the book, there's a bunch of, you know, fiscal financial incentives, but you, and this is not a new idea, is to create carbon funds for, you know, basically financially rewarding people that actively keep their land uncultivated, you know, penalize or prohibit farmers from, you know, draining key ecosystems like, you know, peatlands or destroying mangroves for shrimp production and so forth. So you really have to have in mind conservation when you're doing agricultural policy, because you, as we said, there is like a tension between the two things. For fisheries and ocean conservation, there are, you know, various policies. Some have to do with, just as we said, delineating some no catch, you know, no mining areas, the so-called marine protected areas, and those have to be 30% of the ocean. So each country has to do their share. But countries have, you know, their coastal area is under their jurisdiction. And then there's the open seas and their, you know, treaties that regulate the open seas. But this can be, of course, internationally coordinated. But there's also a lot of things that, why is fish depleted so fast? What makes it possible? Well, basically, there's one culprit here, and that's, you know, marine diesel. Most commercial fishing would not be able to go so far out at sea to chase with sonars and military equipment fishes in all parts of the oceans for a profit if, you know, the fuel wasn't so cheap and if they didn't receive subsidies also from government. So redressing the subsidies to sustainable forms of, you know, fishery, which could be shallow trawlers or no trawlers, regenerative ocean farming, which, you know, doesn't actually involve fishes, but just, you know, scallops, clams, and seaweeds. These are light and high effective ways to completely transform the sectors in a way that it also allows the delivery of conservation objectives, which, as we know, are, you know, one of the three pillars of the carbon sinks of how we're going to save the planet. Okay, so there's mitigation, there's carbon sinks, and then, of course, there's the social population growth aspect. So I think, you know, I just wanted to give you some flavor about this too, but the book does go into details, for example, how some countries, I make the example of Bhutan or Costa Rica, go about their conservation policies. How can they enmesh conservation into a successful economy and a successful agricultural production? They do, and we can follow their example, so we can tailor other examples to our needs. But there is a big role for public policy, and including, you know, being able to monitor conservation through satellite imageries, to even facial recognition of fauna, and all that can be shaped by the right policies. And we discuss those policy in detail in the book.
Yeah, and we appreciate just the breadth and kind of overview of the policies and mechanisms available. And again, to reiterate what you just mentioned, the book goes into more options as well as more details within those options. And some of those options come with success stories and kind of notions of where they've been used and how they've been used well. And so as we're coming to a close, I just want to say thank you for joining us. And we took a big chunk of your time. And I know this book is brand new off the press. So how are you seeing it being utilized, and kind of what are you working on now that the book is out there?
Well, I have a number of outlets, and I'm presenting it in various international fora, including the Science Day at the UN Food Systems Summit, which is coming up this July, and then in the fall for the Leader Summit. But I really would like to be, you know, distributed in academia and becoming like, you know, a vademecum for both policymakers, but also people interested in the sector. In the sector, you know, people that work in the sector, to get a frame around, you know, the way we should think about these issues and how we can, you know, work synergistically across a number of disciplines to fix the problem. This is, I see it as the biggest problem and challenge we have. Fossil fuels is very important. It's key, but, you know, like Johan Rockström says, it's the easy part. What's complex is the carbon sinks and food, and we really need to have all hands on deck to fix the problem. So I'm going to go out there and make a lot of noise with the book in my hand.
Well, the fact that I have it in my hand, I know for certain I'm going to be adopting some of these chapters into the food and ag policy courses I teach at the graduate level. So I really appreciate you and your colleagues taking all the time and energy that goes into creating an edited volume, because I think it does bring a lot of discussion to the table and presents some information that, like you mentioned, was a little bit sketchier.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was great being with you today.
Thanks again. Thank you.
Bye-bye.